Don't frighten us by telling us the facts. 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 We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on May 27th, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate and Rachel joined me to discuss Paulette Jordan's campaign for Idaho governor, then Reverend Barber's Poor People's campaign, and then the crimes against humanity of the ICE agency. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week is Nate. Hello, Nate.
Hey, Bill.
Joining us on the line, as usual, from Idaho is Rachel. Hey, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Great to be here.
So we wanted to start off this week's show by kind of wrapping up the discussion that we were having last week, since we mentioned that you were not able to be on the show last week, Rachel, but there was some news from Idaho that we wanted to have you talk about. Tell us about that.
A couple weeks ago, we had our Idaho primary, and Paulette Jordan was the runaway winner of the gubernatorial primary for the Democratic Party. She received almost 60% of the vote, despite being outspent by A.J. Blukoff by 6-1. So she definitely got a lot of bang for her buck, and she really inspired a lot of people to go to the polls and vote for her. And I think this is definitely exciting for us, and it's made national headlines because she would be the first female governor in Idaho's history and also the first Native American governor in America's history. So that is definitely super, super exciting for us. She's a really progressive candidate. She's big on public lands. Apparently she's pro marijuana legalization, which I really wasn't aware of, but that's super exciting as well. I just wanted to highlight a few articles about her after her win. So in the Rexburg Standard Journal, this is deep in the heart of Eastern Idaho, Mormon country. Rexburg is the home of BYU Idaho. The columnist Neil Larson was very, kind of concerned. His headline was "Warning: Do not underestimate Paulette Jordan." So he highlighted those things I just mentioned, first female governor, first Native American governor. And he's kind of ringing the bells of warning for the Republicans. He mentioned that in 2005, he watched C-SPAN and saw a clip of President Obama prior to his presidency, and he said, after just a minute or two of watching, alarm bells went off in my head that the GOP needs to pay attention to this incredibly smooth, dynamic young politician. And then just a few short years later, he was our president. So he's kind of drawing the parallel for sure. He said, "Optically, Jordan wins. She's young and attractive. She's energetic and well-spoken. She has plenty of poise to stand on a stage with Brad Little, who, with inevitable national and regional media participation, will be characterized as the boring, aging white guy." So he's kind of throwing identity politics in the mix, saying, yeah, she's young and exciting and history making, but don't let this sway you from voting for Brad Little. And he also kind of invoked the specter of Bernie Sanders, too. He said, "I'm also concerned that Jordan, like Bernie Sanders, has the potential to activate groups that have never, and would never otherwise, step foot into a polling location. So those darn kids are going to vote, which they probably never do in Idaho. I think our youth voter turnout is abysmal. So I think he's pointing out how an excited Democratic base and a kind of depressed Republican base with like the loss of Raul Labrador, kind of the Tea Party candidate, might have the potential to depress the GOP vote in November. So it's kind of funny to juxtapose that with like Teen Vogue has talked about how exciting her candidacy is. And in the Indian Country Media Network, they highlighted how history making this is. So the Rexburg column was, oh no, she's cool. And then every other opinion piece out there is saying, yay, she's cool. So it's kind of funny to have, they're saying the exact same things about her attractiveness, her poise, her her ability to excite the electorate. So it's kind of funny to, they're saying the same things, but with a very different tone and message behind it.
Yeah, there was, I'm just looking at a write-up that she got in Indian Country Media Network, and sort of highlighting from the Native American perspective there. And they're sort of going over how she's, you know, she's been written off already by the New York Times, like can't possibly win because, you know, three times more people voted in the Republican primary. But they're also pointing out that she's sort of uniquely poised to reach out to people basically all over. So they talked a little about the tech jobs in Boise and sort of that's kind of a burgeoning thing there, as you know, living there and participating in that. So so they point out that she could potentially be an inroad there, and as well as Native American voters. So they're only 1% of the population, but among young voters, the number climbs to 3.3%. So, and of course, probably more so in Idaho, but they're pointing out that, let's see, she was getting a decent amount of, was pointing out the necessity of contributions from Native Americans and saying that she's getting a decent amount of support from, I believe it's Nez Perce, her own Coeur d'Alene tribe, Shoshone, Bannock, and Kootenai, right? And so, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, you know it better than I there. So, yeah, exactly. So it does kind of seem, and they also, another article points out sort of a rising Hispanic population. There's also a lot of foreign-born people who are maybe refugees or, but have now been registered to vote. And it's interesting. She's, Jordan's getting write-ups in like Teen Vogue and BuzzFeed and things like that. So definitely seems like there's sort of an increased media spotlight on her now and will be more so in the run-up to the election.
Yeah, that last paragraph really sums it up. And it kind of made some of the points that I made during our Idaho leftist focus episode. Idaho has a history of defying the odds. Frank Church, a liberal Democrat, won a Senate seat when he was only 32 years old, and Democrat Cecil Andrus won the governor's chair four different times. Church's strength was his intellect. Andrus was a great storyteller, and Jordan owns cool. So I think if you get a candidate that's exciting to Democrats and to some of those independent voters, of which I think Idaho has a lot of, given our like trailblazing Western philosophy, I think we can really sway a lot of those voters to vote for Jordan.
Yeah, and it really does seem like she's using rural issues as sort of the core of her campaign when that's often neglected by Democrats, sometimes even ones from rural areas or rural states. They don't really make that front and center of their campaign, but I think she is because, you know, she's got a strong connection to the land there, and she really wants to, you know, make sure those people are, because I mean, that's a huge part of Idaho. I mean, you can't just say, okay, we're only going to speak to the people in Boise and then expect to get elected. So the Indian Country article also notes that she probably needs to make some inroads into Mormon counties and maybe needs to find some strong surrogates who are LDS, Church of Latter-day Saints, just to maybe lower that number that's going to vote Republican, and then maybe shave off a couple, because you never know. Needs to reach union workers and basically round up enough every Democrat, independent, and enough Republicans to put her over the top. So, you know, it's a possibility. I mean, I don't know what the chances are realistically here, but it seems like this is probably a better shot than we would have gotten with, what's his name? AJ.
Bolotov. Yeah, definitely. I think the enthusiasm would have definitely been way lower for him. And I think some of the younger Mormons, just growing up with a huge Mormon population in Caldwell, Idaho, I think the younger generation is much more social justice minded. They've always been kind of a good works sort of faith. And I think a lot of that can be kind of judoed into Democrat values. So I think she, if she finds those good surrogates to kind of get her message out into the community, I think she would have a fairly good chance. I think 8% voted for Evan McMullen, and I guarantee it was those Eastern Idaho Mormons that were just very disgusted and very not enamored of Trump. So I think kind of using that, like, the good optics and just not being really morally and ethically disgusting will help her case a lot.
even the extremely socially conservative Mormons, and it seems like that's lessening among the younger generation, but even socially conservative Mormons are typically sort of like a pro-immigrant, pro-cosmopolitan stance, at least relatively, just because of their experience being persecuted and fleeing out west and the history of that. And, you know, that's sort of incompatible with the rising nativism and nationalism that sort of the Trump Republican Party is pushing. So,
right. Yeah, that's a huge part of their, like, collective story. Definitely, for sure.
I did also want to highlight her running mate that was announced. And as you mentioned, it's technically a separate race, but she announced Kristen Collum is the only Democrat running for lieutenant governor. But I guess they announced that they're running as a joint ticket. And Collum was originally from Montana, enlisted in the Army right out of high school, spent a dozen years in the military, worked at the Pentagon with Colin Powell. Okay, interesting. Maybe that's a check against her. But she worked in Boise's tech sector, worked at Hewlett-Packard, Micron. And so it seems like there's five GOP candidates.
Yeah, I didn't pay attention to who won. I think it was Janice Bagichin, and her mailer featured a picture of her with Don Jr., and that seemed to be attractive to the GOP primary voters, who tend to be more of the rabid base, actually make it out to the primary. So I think that was actually a compelling image. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see, because she seemed like, I think she also on her mailer, there were pictures of her holding guns as well. And she's a restaurant owner, and she said she would allow all her employees to get their concealed carry license or something like that. It was a very odd mailer. So I don't think that will be as compelling to the broad electorate as it is to more of the base voters. So should be interesting to see how that race shakes out as well. Also, I wanted to point out that our current governor served as lieutenant governor under the Democrat Cecil Andrus during the late 80s and early 90s. So we have experienced a split between the governor and lieutenant governor. And also, I wanted to point out that the entire Democratic ticket for statewide offices, so governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, and superintendent of education, are all women this year. And I think that's the first time that's happened in Idaho as well. So it's very exciting for women Democrats, for sure.
Well, that does it for us on Idaho. Let's move on now to talk about Reverend William Barber and the Poor People's Campaign. Obviously, this has been, you know, something that's been continuing for several years now, but somewhat under the radar. Obviously, like, I think most progressives are aware of it, but, you know, if somebody doesn't necessarily follow the progressive news all that closely or leftist news all that closely, you might not be that aware of it. There was another round of campaigning in the past week or so on that front. Nate, talk us through a little bit of that.
Yeah, I think there's actually, I believe there's a protest planned tomorrow in D.C. I've been seeing some.
Oh, this would be on Memorial Day, right?
Right, yeah. And that's just been, you know, seeing that on the Twitter timeline from the various state poor people's campaigns, because now that's sort of a spread out model where you have basically a poor people's campaign in every state working on local issues. So that's important. But I do want to highlight sort of, I was flipping through the New Yorker a couple weeks ago, and there was a long profile by Jelani Cobb about William Barber, who is the pastor who's sort of leading this Poor People's Campaign. He had the Moral Monday protests down in, I believe, was Durham.
Oh, Raleigh, not Durham, the right, capital of North Carolina.
Okay, yeah. So that was a big thing for a while, and now he's sort of taking it on the road and taking it to D.C. and basically all over the place. And so, yeah, and no, this there's an interesting article also in The Guardian. Jesus Never Charged a Leper a Copay, The Rise of the Religious Left, and sort of opens with the juxtaposition of the embassy opening in Jerusalem, where you have Robert Jeffers, evangelical pastor, who said that Donald Trump was a moral leader who stood on the right side of you, O God. And then half a world away, outside of the Capitol in Washington, Reverend William Barber led a moment of silence for the 60 Palestinians killed by Israeli soldiers, and talking about there's no religious right or religious left. There's only a moral center, and the scripture is very clear where you have to be in the moral center. You have to be on the side of the poor, the working, the sick, and the immigrant. And, you know, he talks about how he worries that religious faith is being cynically used by some to serve hate, fear, racism, and greed. And so this is sort of, this has now been bubbling up over the past couple years. I feel like I heard about Moral Mondays like maybe 5 years ago, or maybe even longer ago than that. And then now this is sort of taken on a momentum into the actual kind of poor people's campaign that Martin Luther King would have hopefully envisioned had he not been assassinated right as it was starting. I wonder why that happened. And so we are now seeing this sort of an actual physical religious left movement. And it's not just him. It's other people like Reverend Liz Theo Harris. And basically they, between Barber and Theo Harris, they imagine a new Southern strategy that undoes racial divisions. So they're, you know, trying to unite poor and working class communities deep in Trump country. So both black and white voters and Hispanics and Asians and all other people as well to basically come together and work on these types of issues. This article also interviews people talking about how the left has long been ill-equipped to rival Christian conservatives' alliance with Republicans, and people are talking about how progressive people of faith would be better served by sort of a, this site's indivisible, you know, whatever you think about that particular organization. It seems like, you know, people need to be coming together and, you know, different faith communities coming together to actually get out and do things. So it says, Reverend Barber has a great moral message, he says, but I don't want the next Democratic candidate for president to feel like he has to go kiss the ring to get elected. So it's probably better that this is, you know, taking on local issues and not just having this one figure. You know, he has, I think Barber has like a spinal condition where it makes it, you know, pretty tough for him to move around and things like that. So, you know, this is not all on him. This has got to be a widespread movement to actually, you know, bring people together and actually change material conditions for people.
So. Right. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that happened after the MLK assassination, which is basically what the goal of the assassination was, is that a lot of the movement kind of stalled. And there were obviously other figures certainly involved in the civil rights push of the 50s and 60s. But like, he was such a central figure, and all these other people were such secondary figures at the time, and people who were, you know, nowhere near as famous. Like that kind of took the wind out of the sails, and things just really went into a stall at that point. And then you got this sort of weird thing where some of those secondary figures, you know, some of them went into elected office after that, but then you had figures like you know, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, who become, you know, to use that phrase that Nate was just citing from the article, these figures where people would go kiss the ring, but it wasn't like they had been designated by anyone to be in charge of anything particularly, like, and they were just sort of figures who were still around at the time after the assassination. And I think that if there's any hope of some movement like this succeeding, it's got to be that distributed model where it's not just all on one person and it doesn't completely fall apart if one person goes away. I mean, he could pass away from, you know, medical issues or something like that, from this condition or something, you know, or be totally immobilized and not be able to leave the house. Like, the, you know, it can't all be put on one person, and that's too much to ask of anyone anyway. So hopefully this more distributed organizing model is a little bit more effective.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, there's others as well, but I think it does need to be a sort of a broad-based movement. And, you know, as I mentioned with the evangelical example, that's really when the Republican Party started taking power in America, was when they sort of wrested control of the party away from sort of the Northeastern elites that had previously controlled it, sort of the Bushes and whatnot, even though they were happy to ally with these evangelicals when it suited them. But sort of now the power base in the Republican Party is very much, you know, with the evangelicals, with the, you know, people that actually get out and vote. And I think the issue here is now trying to build a similar movement on the left that actually, you know, you can't just ignore all the people in America that go to church. I don't think that's going to work out well for you if you want to actually take political power. So you need to find a way to incorporate them and, you know, let them lead on issues where that's appropriate. And so, you know, this is, it does seem like this is going to be a key issue moving forward. I do want to talk about some of their sort of demands. And so obviously, care for the poor, heal the sick, and all of that. You know, the original Poor People's Campaign featured a demand for sort of universal basic income, in a sense, or like a living income. And, you know, you have all sorts of other issues that are tied up in that. So they want a, you know, they're focusing on Trump's policies on healthcare and the environment and all sorts of sort of a broad-based platform in a way. And so they've called for repeal of the Republican tax cuts. They want minimum wage laws. They want universal single-payer health care. So similar, and the article notes, these are similar to the demands of politicians like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And they've also like interviewed, you know, Warren, Sanders, and I think there are, they, quoting Cornel West, he's the real deal, says Cornel. So, but they, I don't think they're actually endorsing any candidates. So says Theo Harris, we're surely trying to impact politics. We're trying to make sure that our elected officials take these issues seriously, but that goes far beyond any one election or election year. So I think that can be useful in the sense that it doesn't sort of dissipate after the election's over. You just sort of have this broad base that can push people at election time. But at the same time, it's not going to just go away by the end there.
I think some of the points you were making are interesting in that, yeah, it needs to be both an electoral and non-electoral movement, but also that there is this potential sort of untapped reserve of people who, like, are religious and faith oriented, but don't agree with these evangelical positions. You know, the prosperity gospel stuff that powered the far right into electoral power within the Republican Party and then the country as a whole. Like, you want to be able to get out those people who, like, do care about poor people and that sort of
thing. Yeah. So to quote Barber, they say so much about the issues where the Bible says so little. He says of the religious right, but they speak so little about the issues where the Bible says so much. Jesus set up free healthcare clinics everywhere he went. He healed everyone and never charged a leper a copay. Then he also criticizes the sort of dog whistling of the Republican Party. And slave master religion has a strange morality that you could somehow worship on Sunday and still have slaves on Monday, he says. But as we would say today, these preachers were not practicing religion. They were practicing racism under the cover of religion. We still see some of that today. So I think that's a sort of pretty blunt statement there. And, you know, it also seems like his, you know, only like a couple of years ago, like it was sort of like a niche thing to sort of know about who he is and the Moral Monday marches and such. But now it's sort of, he's gone mainstream and is sort of, people are taking notice of him.
Rachel, your comments on this?
I just wanted to highlight a sentence from the article. When he mentions the good book, he is as likely to be referring to Howard Zinn's progressive primer, A People's History of the United States, as he is to the one that contains the Old and New Testaments. So I think there's definitely something to be said about how, like Bill was saying, we need to bring in people of faith into the left. I think, especially amongst young people, we've kind of embraced like this atheistic worldview, and I think it can be very alienating to people of faith. So as long as we kind of reach out to the people of faith with like a compassionate and empathetic message, I think we can definitely draw them in to the left, because that's what we're striving for. We're striving to be a more compassionate society and to take care of people in need. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think this is an example of how that can be done without compromising on social issues or, you know, other mm-hmm. things like that, where it's, you know, we need to take a hard line there and not sort of be willing to overlook things. But at the same time, you know, these are actually people that are getting out and motivated by their religion and their, you know, desire to help people. So,
right. I mean, there's this tendency, especially among sort of a non-religious chattering class pundit section, of like assuming what religious people believe and then saying mm-hmm. like all religious people believe the same exact things and with the same weighting on specific mm-hmm. things. And that's obviously not true. I mean, that's like, that should be the most obvious thing in the world, right? Like, you can talk to almost anyone and there's so many different sects in the United States. There's huge emerging growing faith groups that aren't even, you know, within the Christian tradition, or even some of these other ones that we've talked about earlier on this episode. Like, we talked a lot about the Mormons in the last little bit, and I would say there's, like, you know, there's large growing Hindu and Buddhist populations in the United States, and so on and so forth, right? And then there's all the different Christian sects as well, and then like around here in Massachusetts we have a lot of Jewish organizations, like political organizations that promote a Jewish social justice tradition. And so obviously, like, different people who consider themselves to be, you know, religious to varying degrees are going to have different emphasis on different particular issues. And so this idea that, like, that some of these pundits have that, like, the only way to power is to, like, make a bunch of compromises on, like, you know, gay rights and abortion or something like that in order to win over this religious population. I mean, that's absurd. There's plenty of religious people in the United States who don't really care about either of those issues, or it's just not a big factor for them compared to something like a poor people's campaign or whatever. And you know, like, a lot of material needs are going to be addressed for a lot of people, and that might get them involved if you're focusing on that instead.
Yeah, I think a number of the leaders in the Poor People's Campaign are from the United Church of Christ, Protestant denomination there, sort of one of the most liberal of the Protestant denominations. So, but yeah, both, I think, Theo Harris. Actually, Barber is from Disciples of Christ, which I believe they used to be the same. They split off. There's a lot of splits. There's like a huge, you know, taxonomy you could do of all the different Christian traditions. It's insanely complicated, but yeah.
Yeah, I think there's actually multiple Disciples of Christ
right, yeah,
things as well. I'm looking on Wikipedia, and I don't know if this is correct, because this is the first time I'm looking it up. It says it's a mainline Protestant Christian denomination within the Reformed tradition and close ties to the
Congregationalist, you know, this is a very New England type of thing.
Yeah, the Disciples' local churches are congregationalist.
It's just like all the, like, towns in, like, Vermont, New Hampshire, where they just have, like, one big, you know, church in the middle of town, and it's like, been Congregationalists since like 1700s or whatever. So
right.
I wanted to point out that in Boise, one of the hugest LGBT ally groups in Boise, and working very heavily on the Add the Words campaign to add sexual orientation and gender identity to our Idaho Bill of Rights, is the local Presbyterian Church. So there's definitely a huge activist tradition in Christianity and in especially in that particular church as well. So, yeah, definitely need to bring leftists of faith into our organizations and really embrace that activist mindset.
Right. I think even in the past decade or so, a lot of these mainline Protestant churches, you know, I think in general are pretty supportive of LGBT rights, but I think that's, they've been sort of more so and been more upfront about it. And I believe there were some even like doctrinal disputes at like the highest level or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that's usually what you see, these type of things, it's usually sort of a church from that tradition is involved somehow. And then as many others, of course, but that's sort of a common theme there. But yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD, and then we'll be back in just a moment with more. So stick around. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate, and on the line is Rachel. We wanted to talk now more about the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency, ICE, and their latest horrifying crimes against humanity. Nate, where do we start on this?
Well, there was the report that, was it relatively just short of 1,500 immigrant children who are separated from their families have vanished. They've been disappeared.
And you wanted to talk about the fact that it's a little bit active. It's not just that they misplaced them, which would be horrifying.
Well,
enough.
Yeah, that probably exists too. But, you know, we're also seeing a report from January 28, 2016. So happening during the Obama administration. But a Department of Health and Human Services placed more than a dozen immigrant children in the custody of human traffickers after it failed to conduct background checks of caregivers. I think they ended up working. Six children were lured to the U.S. from Guatemala with the promise of a better life. They were made to work on egg farms, and they had been as young as 14. They had been in federal custody before being entrusted to the traffickers. And so, you know, all the claims of cutting down on trafficking, all the Pizzagate people that say Trump is rounding up the pedos, this is what appears to be actually going on. And of course, you know, as we mentioned, this was also going on during the Obama administration. I believe there were also containment centers or internment centers on these military bases that also happened during Obama. But it does seem like they're ramping it up under Kelly. And you're sort of saying, oh, they'll be put in foster care or whatever. So,
yeah, pretty famous quote at this point. We've talked about this before, that the big shift so far compared to the Obama administration, when it was horrifying enough as it was, is that under the Obama administration, a lot of these folks were being deported in pretty significant numbers after detention. The Trump administration seems to largely be holding most of the people rather than actually deporting them because they figured out that they can a lot of people can get rich doing the detention rather than deportation. They don't really make much money off them if they get deported relatively quickly, but if they get held in these private prison facilities,
GEO group,
if they get held in county, you know, public county jails, people are making money off that. The federal government is paying a per head fee, basically, and paying to build facilities and that sort of thing. We have concentration camps in the United States for undocumented immigrants now, and people are being separated at the border, men, women, and children, to go to different locations, which there's no reason to do that. I mean, for the most part, we're not talking about, like, gang members or anything. We're talking about families. And so the idea that for some reason you have to separate them rather than finding them some, you know, family quarters, basically, is absolutely absurd, and this is all intentionally done.
Right.
This
ICE has a bus with all the little children's seats. Just seeing a picture of that, so they've got the baby van there to take them directly to the internment centers or whatever. Where I think there were pictures coming out. This was also under Obama, so not current conditions, which are maybe now worse, but there was just like kids like lying on mats, and then there's like a chain link fence in front of them, and you know, other such things that I think we've discussed in the past, where they have this like it's almost like a shiny metal or something, almost plastic or something that serves as our blankets or whatever. So
like a astronaut blanket or whatever, or one of those camping foils to keep you from getting right. too cold at night.
And so meanwhile, Trump is furious at Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen because of surge in illegal border crossings, they claim. And so now, he's yelling at them, and, they're trying to deny that there's discord. It's like, oh, she's an impossible no-win situation. He believes that she's a Bush Republican.
Which she is. As far as I can tell, her only background is that she was an attorney in the Bush administration.
But this is a telling anecdote here. So this was before Trump's first speech to Congress in February. He huddled up with Kushner and Stephen Miller in the Oval Office talk immigration. And basically he was saying them that the crowds loved his rhetoric on immigrants along the campaign trail, acting as if he were in a rally. He recited a few made-up Hispanic names and then described potential crimes they could have committed, such as rape or murder. Then he said the crowds would roar when the criminals were thrown out of the country, as he did when he highlighted crimes by illegal immigrants at his rallies, according to a person present for the exchange, and another briefed on it later. Miller and Kushner laughed. So does seem like this is a thing that he knows his base loves, and it's kind of the feedback loop there, because that's really all he cares about.
And apparently his speechwriter Miller, the one who's been writing some of the most fascist speeches that he's given in his entire administration so far, he's still there. He's one of the people that has not been fired from the White House, as far as I know. And I was asking around about this the other day, and people said, yeah, he's still there. So, he's a real génocidaire. Rachel, what elements did you want to focus on here?
Oh, so he's also blaming her for not securing funds for the anti-immigrant wall, border wall in bordering Mexico. I don't really know how that's her fault. Congress is in charge of appropriating funds, so he just wants to strike out at the person who he sees as the problem, but it's obviously not her problem. So this is definitely in his playbook, just strike out at the person closest to him irrationally. So And I mean, I'm team nobody. I'm certainly not on Nielsen's team. So it's an awful situation all the way around.
One thing I think, that we wanted to focus on in this is a reminder of how systemic this is. This is not a new thing under Trump, as Nate was alluding to by repeatedly referencing the fact that some of this stuff was happening under the Obama administration, and it is the moral responsibility of the Democrats and President Obama to have ended this when they had the chance and they did not do so. But this is not just a both sides do it narrative that we're making here. This is to point out that, this is part of a very, very long legacy. There was a WGBH.org article that I found from 2015 that was talking about a Truth and Reconciliation Commission on Indigenous abductions in Maine. And they talk about at the national level that there was a 1976 report commissioned by the Association on American Indian Affairs that found that as many as one third of Native American children were separated from their families between 1941 and 1967, which is only a policy that ended 51 years ago at this point. And that is a lot of people, who are still around, plenty of people who this was happening in their lifetimes, and they were doing the testimony in Maine specifically, where this was like the first place where that there was one of these commissions set up. But like these abductions were within recent memory of a ton of people. And that's like just one specific example of large numbers of children being abducted by the United States government for some, nefarious civilizing purposes or whatever.
Yeah, the residential schools program was designed to Christianize or civilize the, supposed savage that was the Native American tribes who had lived here, for thousands of years before we showed up and started wrecking things up. But, this is part of the policy of genocide to try to eliminate their culture, eliminate, their sense of self as an indigenous person. So that's part of it. I think also I saw even today, think in Alaska, 50% of all children in foster care are Native American or Inuit or something to that effect. So that was being highlighted today, and a lot of Native Americans were using this incident with ICE to talk about their, you know, continuing struggles on this issue. And I think I saw there was a short interview with someone who had been to one of these residential schools. I think it's also worth noting that, you know, for a lot of people, this wasn't just them being separated from their families and having their culture destroyed. A lot of these people just disappeared. A lot of people just, they vanished. So they were disappeared. It wasn't like something that just happened to them. A lot of people were killed, you know, buried in secret, things like that. So this is extremely serious. And I think it's also worth noting there was a lot of this done to the Black community as well, where Black mothers had their children taken away. And, you know, that, of course, is still going on. So this
I mean, that's like the longest through line in American history, right? You know, before there was the United States, you had slave auctions, you know, children being ripped away from their mothers. And that continuing to today, we see, you know, every few months there's a news article about some, you know, Black mother whose children are taken away forcibly by the state over some minor BS. You know, it's usually like either it's a minor parole violation or it's even something as simple as like, you know, oh, she let her kids go to the playground to play while she was at a job interview, you know, like next door or something. And, oh, that's neglect and you're not, you know, keeping good enough care of your children, so we're going to take them away. There's all this rhetoric surround, you know, all the welfare queen rhetoric and everything that we've talked about before, that's just brutally racist rhetoric that justifies the state taking away people from their families. The federal government takes away children from their families when they feel like it, and it's, you know, often racially motivated. Sometimes there's a class element. We sometimes see that happening to poor white families as well, to a much less systemic extent, I would say, probably than is happening to these other groups. But you know, this is the kind of stuff that goes down in the history books, and worse, a lot of it is in the history books already, and it's negatively regarded by the history books and the historians, and yet we're still continuing to do this. This is a horrifying act being perpetrated in our name, and I don't know what you're supposed to do about that. I don't know where you draw the line and just at a certain point say that everyone's going to have to step up and stop it themselves, but like, you know.
There have been actions sort of blocking ICE deportation vans and things like that. People were just recently pointing out here in Massachusetts where the ICE deportation center is down by the Burlington Mall. So it's important to sort of keep on your toes about that and sort of know what's going on around you there.
We talked in the last segment about, you know, congregational churches and other liberal churches getting involved in social justice actions. I know there's a church in Springfield, Massachusetts, that's been giving literal sanctuary in the sanctuary to a man, I think from Central America, who is, you know, the ICE is trying to take him away, and he hasn't done anything, you know, other than that he was here without documentation. He hasn't done anything particularly wrong. They even had to sneak him out to the hospital for emergency medical treatment a week or so ago, and he was successfully brought back to the church without being apprehended. But they've just got ICE agents basically parked outside trying to get at him. And that's like one, you know, one man. There's a ton of people putting in effort to try to protect this guy, and we have to do this for millions of other people. And I, you know, it's a daunting task against this abusive surveillance state with nearly unlimited powers that is continuing to dramatically overstep its bounds and routinely deports people who are U.S. citizens, including naturalized and U.S.-born U.S. citizens. And so, like, it's a very frightening prospect to go up against these guys.
I did see also one story recently, and there's another story I want to touch on quickly, but there was a guy who is going to be deported back to Central African Republic, and he's just like, no, my mother was just tortured and killed there, I'm not going to go, and basically refused to be deported. And since the airline can't actually fly him if he refuses, they basically just kept him in the cell there. So he's not leaving, I guess, but he's not free either. So that's the situation he finds himself in.
A lot of these people are obvious asylum candidates, yeah. Like the one you just mentioned, like a lot of these folks from Central America. They keep talking about MS-13, you know, from this administration as part of their boogeyman. MS-13 is a Central American gang that consisted entirely at its inception of people who were refugees from Central America due to the policies of the United States government explicitly, or they were people who were sent back, forcibly deported by the United States to Central America, and in order to protect themselves or whatever, they formed these organizations that eventually morphed into criminal enterprises like MS-13 that are brutally violent. And now a lot of the people who are coming are fleeing that violence. So it is now the secondary wave of U.S.-backed violence that is leading to this current arrival.
Yeah. And then, of course, Trump, with his, you know, animals comments, you know, dehumanizes people and preps them for being okay with, say, deaths at the border, which is what I talk about, because there was just a shooting of a, by the Border Patrol, of a an immigrant, a 20-year-old Claudia Patricia Gomez Gonzalez, who is a Maya Mon Cree, or indigenous woman, and coming from Guatemala. And so she was shot and killed by a Lauren Border Patrol agent in Rio Bravo, Texas. And initially, they claimed that the Border Patrol agent came under attack by multiple subjects using blunt objects. And then they had to release a second statement with a different version of events, which made no mention of the blunt objects. And he apparently, the agent ordered the immigrants to get on the ground, but they ignored his command and instead rushed him. And so, you know, probably more like rushed away, but now a person's dead, and they're just sort of fudging the story. And I believe she was been like a forensic graduate, and she was coming to further her education here in America. So, you know, these are the people coming across the border, contrary to Trump's sort of animals comment. They're fleeing from MS-13 and the destruction we've caused, you know, through our policies supporting all sorts of right-wing death squads all around Central America as part of the Cold War. So, you know, there was a genocide of Maya in Guatemala,
which we've talked about previously on the show. We talked about the Rios Montt and that sort of thing. Rachel, you wanted to talk about some of this as well?
Yeah, I also wanted to point out that as she was an educated person just seeking further education, so she would have definitely been a model citizen had we allowed her to come and achieve that education.
Not that there's anything wrong with the uneducated
exactly,
people either.
Exactly. Everybody's human. They're all just looking to better their lives. There was just that caravan of asylum seekers walking through Mexico and reaching our border a few weeks ago, I believe. And just the dehumanizing language that Trump used about these people that were just seeking a life away from violence and away from extreme poverty that we have definitely caused with our foreign policy. It's just really disgusting on a whole bunch of facets, just how we are causing violence and destabilization across the world. And then we don't want to help the people that we have harmed. So it's just really disgusting. And also, I wanted to point out that Radiolab just did a series on how when we tightened our borders in the 90s, the amount of people dying in the desert on more dangerous border crossings increased by the thousands each year. There wasn't really a need for to do this because we were talking earlier before recording, Bill was mentioning that migrant workers would come in, work during like harvesting seasons, and because it was so easy to cross, they would just go back. But once we tightened the borders and made it difficult to cross, the migrant workers would just stay. So we've definitely harmed these people and exacerbated the problem just with our stupid policy.
All of this is of our own making. This is all, every facet of this is of our own making. And as you said, like, when we create a problem, we don't do anything to deal with the consequences except complain about it. Like, there's even the people who worked as translators for the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan can't even get their asylum cases processed. And you would think that's like the highest priority level of people you would take care of, and they're not even doing that, so there's no hope for anyone else.
Yeah, and wasn't that a lie that we basically told them to get them to work for us? So yeah, it's terrible. And I think Nate was mentioning some of these asylum seekers were getting deported and then stating that they were going to be killed. And that's exactly what has happened. I think many activists and political figures were trying to seek asylum and then have been shot on their return. I think in Guatemala especially, and I think Ecuador as well, there's been some political activists getting killed on their return fairly quickly too.
Yeah, there's a lot of these types of murders, especially of, say, indigenous people, environmental activists, people like that who are, you know, just a little too inconvenient. And then, you know, whether it's the police or people affiliated, and, you know, they just, there was also the case in Brazil recently where a local politician was killed. So, you know, this is definitely part of it. I think. Also, Rachel, this is maybe of some relevance to you. I think I saw a sort of a viral video of people up in, I think it was Montana, perhaps, but they were just like speaking Spanish at a gas station, and then Customs and Border Patrol like comes up to them and starts like harassing them, asking them for papers, and because, of course, Spanish speaking must be illegal. So that led to a thing. So I think we're definitely seeing it's not just ICE. It's Customs and Border Patrol. It's, you know, Homeland Security. It's airport security. They were harassing people during the Muslim ban situation. So this is kind of seems like we're in a position, especially with this recent murder. I think there's been 97 murders. I think I saw that somewhere. This is definitely only one. But, you know, of course, they kick over the water that people leave out as well. And I think it's a crime to leave out water now. And, you know, I think we're at a point where, you know, we're just going to start mowing people down as they approach the border. I really don't think we're all that far away from that, considering that's sort of a just more extreme version of what we're already doing.
This isn't going to go away after Trump leaves office unless something is done that's on a significant scale. This is such a large problem. This is such a deeply rooted systemic problem in the United States. As someone said, what do you do when there are crimes of this scale being committed in your name? Well, I don't know what you do. Do what you have to do, I guess. Morally, anybody can do whatever they want to stop this, and you're going to be morally in the clear, and history is going to back you up if you do something to stop this, but that's up to you to figure out.
Yeah, I saw a lot of people making, you know, of course, the Germany comparisons, people just following orders, the good Germans, they looked on, they knew what was happening, but they did nothing, so we're kind of in that position now. Very unfortunate, but that's what it is.
All right, Nate, thank you for being in studio this week.
Thanks, Bill.
And Rachel, thank you for being on the line with us.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDradio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on arsenalfordemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.